Coming up on Fronteras, tuberculosis has been killing people for thousands of years, and despite effective therapies, it remains one of the leading causes of death.
Tuberculosis still accounts for several million cases per year, approximately 9 million cases per year. Many of them die. So it is still a significant problem worldwide.
We'll look at the fight against TB in the border city of Tijuana, where there are more cases than anywhere else in Mexico. Also, this border city is bringing in people and getting a big boost from a soccer team.
You got this city with a real bad reputation. It's showing off to the league how great of an experience it is to be here.
How a scrappy soccer team and its diehard fans are helping bring San Diego and Tijuana together. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. The election is over, but the analysis continues. It turns out that sleeping giant, the Latino vote, actually woke up and made a big difference in the election. Now that the votes are mostly counted, we asked Peter O'Dowd at the Fronteras desk to see just how important this group was for a few key races in the West.
Once the dust settles, researchers at the polling firm Latino Decisions say 2012 will be historic. The group's Gabriel Sanchez says a poll conducted just before Election Day suggests a record 75% of Latinos voted for President Obama.
So the Latino vote being overwhelmingly in favor of the president is definitely a big part of the story. I think you can say definitively was probably what put him over the top in a lot of these key states.
And some of those key states in the West showed even stronger support.
Check this number out. 80% of Latino voters in the state of Nevada voted for President Obama.
Latino Decisions called Hispanic voters in battleground states like Colorado and Nevada part of the Western firewall that helped protect the president's lead. Nevada's Latinos now make up 27% of its population. And in Las Vegas, Monse Garcia represents that growing clout. She's 20 years old and voted early for Mr. Obama.
So it was my first time voting, so it was important for me to go out there. I mean, everyone signed up, my best friend. I was like, you gotta go. But we had like a voting party. We carpooled to the mall, and we all voted.
By Wednesday morning, the president had won Nevada by 6 points, thanks in part to strong voter turnout in Clark County. That's home to Las Vegas, where nearly 20,000 additional Latinos registered this year compared to 2008. But the region's changing demographics could be felt in more than just presidential politics. Further east, in Texas, all eyes were on Congressional District 23, where Tea Party incumbent Francisco Canseco lost his seat to Democrat Pete Gallego. Here's Gallego thanking supporters Tuesday night.
I am one of those that will tell you that I cannot, no se puede solo, I can't do it. Alone, there's 29 counties.
You heard that right, 29 counties. It's one of the largest districts in the country, covering a humongous stretch along the U.S.-Mexican border.
There's a lot of voters, as we're seeing tonight, and all of you help get that message out, and all of you help make a difference to bring us to this spot.
Observers say this race was a window into the future of Texas politics. To win, Gallego had to come from behind to outlast a powerful block of conservative white voters around San Antonio. Ultimately, the district's majority Latino electorate preferred the Democrat, even though those voters are often cited for poor turnout at the polls. But in Arizona, a completely different story.
Who knows more about Mexico and immigration than the sheriff does?
At 80 years old, Joe Arpaio easily won a sixth term as sheriff of Maricopa County. That's despite a massive effort to energize Latino voters in a campaign called Adios Arpaio. The group registered more than 30,000 voters in the days leading up to the election. Arpaio acknowledged the effort.
I want to mobilize a Latino community in a civil way. Come, let's get together, let's talk. And I try to do that, but it's got worse and worse and worse. Very sad what they're doing to this sheriff.
By the 2012 election, Arizona's registered Latino voters had surpassed 500,000. So that's why Adios Arpaio's Daria Ovide says this wasn't a total defeat.
No, this is a steady pattern of growth in a community of color that will soon be a majority in Arizona. And we keep going. We keep growing.
While analysts and advocates continue to say, wait till next year, that Arizona's Latino vote will wake up someday, it may just be that Arizona is different from other Western states. Republican Senator-elect Jeff Flake put it this way.
Arizonans want somebody who stands for fiscal discipline, limited government, free markets. We're a conservative state, and I think that that's what they wanted.
Flake should know he beat Richard Carmona, a Democrat of Puerto Rican descent, by 5 points. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
When Arizona's congressional map was redrawn, 12 of the state's American Indian tribes campaigned to be in the same district with the hopes of having a stronger, unified voice in Washington. The native vote could be the tiebreaker in Arizona's Congressional District 1 race. The Associated Press has called the race for former Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick. From the Changing America desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Political analyst Fred Salop says it appears that the Native American voting power may just tip the scales in the Democrats' favor.
I think it speaks well for needing to pay attention to the Native American vote, especially in Apache County and Navajo County. Those are counties that make a difference.
Knowing this, Democratic candidate Ann Kirkpatrick spent Election Day on the Navajo Nation.
Everywhere I went, I mean, people know me and they know I've fought for them, and people were just excited, a steady stream of people. We were seeing lines of voters that I had never seen before out there.
Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley gave his employees the day off and urged them to vote. The tribe relies heavily on federal and state funding. Tens and thousands of provisional ballots from both on and off the reservation remain uncounted. Kirkpatrick's Republican opponent Jonathan Payton said in a statement he's waiting for every vote to be counted. A Secretary of State's office spokesman says we may not know the winner of this race for several days. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Tuberculosis kills more than 1.25 million people worldwide every year. It's one of the leading causes of death. For years, the border city of Tijuana has struggled with a high TB rate. A San Diego-based nonprofit has been helping health officials fight the disease throughout Mexico. But reporter Kenny Goldberg says the program's funding runs out at the end of December.
The bacterial infection known as tuberculosis has been traced as far back as the age of Egyptian mummies. Today, the public health arm of the United Nations keeps close tabs on the disease. Dr. Jacob Kumaresan is executive director of the World Health Organization's New York office. He says the disease continues to take its toll.
Tuberculosis still accounts for several million cases per year, approximately 9 million cases per year. And of this, many of them die. And most of them are in the developing world, in Asia and Africa. So it is still a significant problem worldwide.
TB can be cured, but the treatment involves a number of antibiotics that must be taken for at least 6 months. People often start feeling better in a few weeks and then stop taking their medication. Dr. Kumaresan says that's when multidrug-resistant TB can develop.
And this is a very serious problem. So you have to make sure that you account for every patient, manage them properly, and ensure that after 6 months they've been treated and they are completely free of the disease.
That kind of case management is a challenge in Tijuana, where poverty is widespread and public health resources are limited. There are about 800 new cases of TB every year in Tijuana. That's more than in any other part of Mexico.
There are a number of factors that predispose our population to tuberculosis. Here in the community, there are a lot of immigrants, a lot of people who abuse drugs. And this is driving up the number of people who test positive.
Dr. Concepcion Corona Rubio treats TB patients at the Centro de Salud Clinic in downtown Tijuana. He says some immigrants come to Tijuana already infected and then move into poor housing.
Cramped places, poorly ventilated, crowded immigrant shelters. These kind of places facilitate transmission of the disease.
Since 2004, San Diego-based Project Concern International has given Tijuana's fight against TB a major boost. Director Blanca Lomeli says their program, Solución TB, has helped change the way public health officials look at the disease.
So instead of focusing on, X amount of people affected, like you know, just looking at the statistics. Instead of looking at that, you look at the individuals and try to identify why people are getting infected, why people are getting the disease, why they're abandoning treatment, etc., and then you design the program around that.
Solución TB has helped fund the hiring of public health workers who go to patients' homes and make sure they're taking their medicine. It's also encouraged more widespread TB testing to get people diagnosed earlier in the disease process. Dr. Paris Seda-Sed-Kayu heads up tuberculosis services in Tijuana. He says Solución TB has helped the health ministry integrate its TB program with efforts to control HIV and diabetes. People with these diseases are at higher risk of getting TB.
This project has also helped us find people at high risk who we hadn't identified yet. What's more, they provided training for the medical community and public health workers who deal with TB patients.
But funding for Solución TB, which comes from the U.S. Agency for International Development, ends in December. Program Director Blanca Lomeli hopes public health officials will keep up the fight.
What we have learned with TB is that when you stop investing resources in the disease, things go, you know, back up. They go worse. So that's what we hope doesn't happen.
A new president and health secretary will soon be in place in Mexico. Whether they'll maintain the campaign against TB remains to be seen. In Tijuana, I'm Kenny Goldberg.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. This border city is bringing in people and getting a big boost from a soccer team.
You got this city with a real bad reputation. It's showing off to the league how great of an experience it is to be here.
How the team's helping bring San Diego and Tijuana together. Stay tuned. I'm Crystal Chavez. Travel east of Grand Canyon and take in the windswept mesas of Indian country, and you might feel like you're traveling back in time. That sense of timelessness intensifies when you find one dirt road just outside Tuba City, possibly one of the biggest dinosaur track sites in the country. Fronteras reporter Laurel Morales was driving home from a recent assignment and couldn't resist checking it out.
I've passed by the homemade signs dozens of times. Dinosaur tracks and an arrow painted in red. Really? Could they be real? When I pull in, landowner and track tour guide Mark Haskey greets me and tells me to park in front of one of the jewelry stands. We walk past the turquoise necklaces and earrings. The wind whips against the colorful Navajo blankets on display.
My grandma said it's always been here 80 years ago. She used to herd sheep out here, so...
Haskey leads me across the red sandstone mesa. He pours water into an enormous indentation in the rock, a three-toed footprint that he says was made by a T-Rex.
I wear a size 12. Look at it. My foot looks tiny.
He takes me to several fossils and prints of various sizes.
This is Triceratops, that three-horned one. You know what it is, don't you?
Uh-huh.
This is its tracks right here.
Tourists from around the world stop here to see the tracks. They pay anywhere from $10 to $40 for a guided tour. British traveler Adam Brown and his friends stopped on their way to Zion National Park.
We just saw a sign for dinosaur tracks and we're really curious. We thought we'd better stop by and just have a look, see what it's all about.
While there have been many skeptics, the paleontologists I contacted said these tracks are indeed the real thing.
I think it's a fantastic track site from what I could see, just kind of eyeballing it, there's got to be at least 200 dinosaur tracks.
Andrew Milner is a paleontologist in St. George, Utah. He says this site could be one of the biggest in the country, but you need a permit from the Navajo Nation to study it thoroughly. He says the information guides are giving on the tours is not so reliable.
When people visit the site, you know, you need to really take it with a grain of salt, what some people may say. There's some people that really just don't have a clue what's going on there.
Milner says, for instance, the T-Rex track I saw couldn't be a T-Rex track. The tracks embedded in the hard sandstone were most likely made about 195 million years ago in a mudflat along a river and filled in and protected by superfine sediment. The Tyrannosaurus rex didn't show up until 85 million years ago. But there was another infamous dinosaur whose tracks you can see.
One of the most famous types of dinosaurs is one that you see in Jurassic Park, Dilophosaurus. The name means two-crested lizard. We're talking an animal probably maximum size 750 to 1,000 pounds. These are quite large meat-eating dinosaurs. And one of the main characteristics about this dinosaur are these two large crests on the top of the head.
The Huskies don't have trouble with any predatory dinosaurs these days, but they've had a lot of problems with vandals coming out with rock cutters to steal large slabs of tracks from the Husky land. So Mark and his family take turns guarding the tracks at night to keep people from stealing them. The Navajo Nation is building a new tourist center here with fences to protect the tracks.
So what does that mean for your family?
Relief.
Really?
We preserve.
Yeah.
I'm getting old anyway.
Husky, whose children have all moved off the reservation, says it's time to retire. He's grown weary of vandals, tourists, and probably skeptics, too. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Some say Tijuana's vibrant tourist scene is all but extinct. But in its absence, the city's becoming a place for a new type of culture, one forged by people who live between countries and see themselves as part of both. Tijuana's soccer team is part of that. The enormously popular Cholos boast a dedicated fan base that stretches from Sinaloa to Las Vegas. Brooke Binkowski reports from a game in Tijuana.
Dean Mitchell isn't ashamed to admit it. He's a fanatic.
I've been a soccer fan all my life, but I've never had team success. LA, San Diego. So I had to go to Portland, Seattle, places like that to see it, but I always knew Mexico loved it.
Mitchell's having a beer with some friends in the dirt parking lot at Estadio Caliente, Tijuana's soccer stadium, where the Cholos are about to play a match. He lives in San Diego, but he makes the sometimes hours-long trip across the border and back every time there's a game in Tijuana. Mitchell says it's the most fun he's had going to soccer games in years.
The whole city's going nuts, and they haven't had anything before. So you got this city with a real bad reputation that's showing off to the league how great of an experience it is to be here.
Cholos is short for Club Tijuana Cholos Cuintles de Caliente. Cholos Cuintles are hairless dogs, sacred to pre-Hispanic cultures and noted for their unflagging energy, scrappy tenacity, and loyalty. Kind of like the team and its rambunctious, rowdy fans. Inside the stadium, Agustin Diaz is smoking a cigarette by a food stand. He lives in San Diego now, but he was born and raised in Tijuana. Everything he's wearing has the Cholos logo on it, right down to his cape and the big stuffed dog on his hat.
Now that we got a team right here, so I'm 100% with him. I wear my pet El Cholo, I wear my wristband, and even on my cell phone is the Cholo, the big dog and everything. I am super Cholo. Even if they just go down to the second division, I'm still going to be Cholo.
It's not
going to
happen.
No, that for sure is not going to happen.
5 years ago, the Cholos were a barely known second division team. Now they're in the lead in the Mexican League's first division, ahead of legendary teams like Chivas and America. This means, in the soccer world, they're a full-fledged meteoric phenomenon. Wes Braddock is a principal at a San Diego County high school and holds season tickets called Cholo Passes, which cost up to 3,800 pesos, or about $300.
When the Cholos advanced out of what they call the Liga del Ascenso, the Ascending League, and I was at that game that they won that put them into the American, into the Mexican Premier League, it was very similar to me, almost more emotional than when the Chargers went to the Super Bowl in 94. I mean, people were riding up and down the street, honking their horns, waving flags. In the city, it really has been good for the image of the city and the people of the city.
Most of all, he says, it brings residents of San Diego and Tijuana together and showcases their similarities rather than their differences. Roberto Cornejo agrees. He's the Cholos' assistant general manager and a resident of both the U.S. and Mexico. Bringing together the two cities, he says, was his vision all along.
Soccer in San Diego is very big. The majority of kids play either rec or some type of club in their life as they're young. San Diego is an educated population in terms of soccer, and Tijuana has, I think, more links to San Diego than, say, Mexico City or farther south.
Several of the Cholos players are actually from the U.S. side, like midfielder Joe Corona, who grew up in South San Diego County and started his career with the U.S. men's national under-23 team. In the last 2 years, the team's expanded northwards, opening youth academies in San Diego's South Bay and in southwestern Riverside County.
In the academies, we're trying to develop players. If they make it pro with us, that's great. If they're able to get a college scholarship and get their college degree via soccer, and through our training, then that's just as good for us.
This Sunday, the Cholos play Chivas in Guadalajara. If they stay in the top four, which is likely since they're number one, they advance to the playoffs. Reporting from Tijuana, I'm Brooke Binkowski. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversations there. And for headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.